coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Right now, if you were to grow Chardonnay in California and make sparkling champagne from it, you couldn't sell it as champagne. Right. You could only sell it as champagne if you grow it in France by the traditional method, and you make it by the traditional method, and you get this cool international certification. And some of the indigenous groups we talked to, like Umiak in Colombia, said, for us, ayahuasca is not ayahuasca if you don't make it according to traditional practices, grow it in the Amazon, and even serve it in the Amazon. And we think that that's really cool, and that ayahuasca should be afforded the same IP protections or appellations of origin as champagne. And so should peyote. So should all the various native medicines that historically have been appropriated quite widely, to the point that many people don't recognize them as native medicines anymore, and they just recognize them as ordinary general medicine. So appellations of origin are a protective measure that can be taken at the international level to make sure that the only ayahuasca called ayahuasca in the radical commercial markets of the future is ayahuasca grown in and prepared in the traditional way from the traditional region.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts, presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. As psychedelics become increasingly popular in the U.S. and beyond, it's imperative that new businesses honor, protect, and profit share with the indigenous communities who are stewards of these medicines. Today on the show, Jesse Hudson, Chief Legal Officer at Woven Science, explains the recent policy paper from Woven's nonprofit El Puente, which focuses on reparations, education, preservation, and inclusion for indigenous wisdom keepers. We begin with Jesse's early work with ICER's Ayahuasca Defense Fund and the case for religious freedom. We discuss the importance of corporate social responsibility in psychedelic medicine and some examples of organizations which are doing it well. Jesse shares El Puente's recent policy paper, including the four pillars of biocultural conservation, appellations of origin, regulatory sandboxes, and financial sharing. We conclude our conversation with the value for psychedelic businesses of preserving, protecting, and giving voice to indigenous communities. Jesse has worked in the psychedelic space for 15 years as a lawyer, consultant, and advisor for organizations including ICER's Ayahuasca Defense Fund, Chacruna Institute, Anthea Health, Sage Institute, Journey Collab, and Vine Ventures. He is Chief Legal Officer at Woven Science, where he leads the nonprofit El Puente, which promotes access and benefit sharing with indigenous peoples and holds 10% of Woven's equity. And now, here's Jesse Hudson. Jesse, welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I'm really interested in your work. I've been interested in Woven for a while. I'm interested in El Puente. And I just love that I'm going to have the privilege of speaking to someone with a real tight, honed legal perspective on psychedelic medicine, which is so rich for our audience. The model that Woven is pursuing, which is a little bit similar, as I can see from here, to something like what Journey Collab is doing, where there is these indigenous reciprocity components. There's a lot that is of value there, and these are models that I'd like to see more of in the psychedelic ecosystem. So all that being said, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Thanks for having me, Eamon. I'm a big fan, love listening to your podcasts, and I'm happy to be here.
So you are the chief legal officer at Woven. What does it mean to be a chief legal officer? Because I imagine that it's not like being a company lawyer. You're doing a lot about the architecture and strategy of the company from a legal perspective. Would you say that's accurate?
That is accurate. It is another title for the same role of general counsel. So most of the job is just being the company lawyer, which they teach you kind of early on in law school is often about finding third-party lawyers to work with. So you're almost coordinating the service providers externally who may be engaged for a particular deal or a particular filing or a particular diligence. And then more broadly, thinking about the strategy when it comes to regulation, especially in a space like this where we have multiple uncertain regulatory futures, right? We have like decriminalization, legalization, medicalization. We have the religious freedom exemptions, and we have a future that may emerge in any one of these possible scenarios or a combination of them all, depending upon, you know, jurisdiction and especially in light of some of the amazing progress that has been made by the decriminalized nature movements all across the country. And then organizations at, like Theracil at the international level and the drug policy working group in the UK. So a big part of the work is this kind of visioning. And I think that's where you were in the title of chief. The chief in part is kind of focusing on the vision and articulating that vision and advancing it. So while most of the job is being company lawyer, the parts that are sometimes most compelling, although law school does teach you and taught me at least to love and appreciate working in legal documents, which I know sounds weird, but sometimes it's just so good to kind of focus on the words on the page and work with them. There's part of the job that involves this broader visioning.
Well, I'm excited that we have an opportunity to talk about your broad vision today, both as it's manifested in this policy paper about El Puente, which we'll talk about, but also I'd love to hear your ideal space that the world of psychedelics moves, because these are, as you've highlighted, a number of different points where psychedelics can come into mainstream culture, and they all have their benefits and their challenges. And I think we've seen so much around medicalization with its benefits and its challenges, but it'd be great to go deeper on that. Before we get into all of those things, when did you first get interested in psychedelics?
First a joke, actually. A friend in his dorm room when I was 15 at a boarding school in the middle of nowhere in rural Virginia, an all-boys school called Woodbury Forest, said, "Trey Anastasio says, take DMT and trip to another world." And I asked myself, what is this guy talking about? So I went and I Googled DMT and I found this amazing repository of information on Arrowhead. Read all these reports from people who'd had these totally transformative experiences that spoke to the kind of book nerd in me reading Lord of the Rings and Wheel of Time growing up, and you know, these amazing fantasy encounters that people have with spirits and one power and all this magic. And I was like, that made real in nonfiction, in these direct narratives. And then they started to talk about these themes that are like mysticism, oneness, one mind, themes of God and the divine and sacred. And as like a, you know, coming of age teenager, 15, 16, this was like manna from heaven for me. You know, it was like nourishment for my soul that was looking to awaken and become an adult, like become a man. And I read as much as I could. And I was like, this is great. And I eventually realized that the people who were writing some of the most interesting stuff were anthropologists in remote communities working with indigenous, you know, native healers who were masters of these medicines in these magical worlds. Like, you know, Wade Davis writes about in his biography of Richard Evan Schulte's time in the Amazon, One River, or writes about in his first big book, The Serpent and the Rainbow, which accounts his journey to Haiti to investigate the source of zombification, finding that it was a shamanic potion made from datura and pufferfish. At first, this pufferfish powder, and then datura paste. And realizing that would, to me, was a game that's worth the candle. It's something that I can study for the rest of my life and find more and more interesting information. Because it not only has all this compelling data about effects and usage and healing and medicine and magic, but it scratches at something ineffable that goes way deeper. And you can take this teleological progress and process all the way to nirvana, all the way to what is like the peak experience of a living being on earth. And so That's my perspective on and what brought me into psychedelics was that just one kind of in passing joke that somebody made in their dorm room when I was 15.
I wonder how many of us who grew up on Lord of the Rings and other fantasy worlds ended up getting super into psychedelics. Because when you're talking about it, I'm like, wow, that sounds like a bit of my path too. It's like growing up in these worlds of wonder and what does it mean to step into other dimensions? And then learning as an adult that you actually can step into other dimensions. There's actually pretty straightforward ways to do that. And then there's all the things that come along with that, that you learn, like healing, for example, and personal development, spiritual development. I mean, when you and I were both first investigating psychedelics, I'm certain you weren't seeing a lot of stuff about how it could heal PTSD, for example. You know, like that wasn't as present. I mean, I don't know if it was in Arrowhead back in the day, but I don't feel like that was so much the conversation as it is now in this world of where it seems like so much of the conversation now is like medicalization, in part because, thank you, Rick Doblin, that's the path to get these legalized and to get people out of jail. And it is extraordinarily healing for trauma and for other disorders of the mind. But it does seem to be that we're like so preoccupied within the space in medicalization, building companies, healing veterans, depression, these things that are just coming up. I kind of miss more of this, more of the conversation about just what does it mean to step into a completely different realm, mm-hmm. and that ineffable space being like voyaging into that is its own benefit, its own value. It doesn't necessarily need to be, quote, medical.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets really interesting, right? It's like, well, if that's equally valid, then what can we do with this? Where can the space go? And it kind of says that it can go somewhere much bigger than it is now. Where similarly to cannabis, which emerged first as this medical thing, at least from a regulatory perspective, and that bloomed and blossomed into this recreational thing, we could have a psychedelics take a very similar route, where already the medical aspect of psychedelics is way bigger than the medical aspect of cannabis was. And taking that as a cue, we may find that the recreational side of psychedelics is way bigger than the recreational side of cannabis is too. And the reason that I say that and find it to be so interesting and a little disruptive is because my perspective, at least, is grounded in the anthropologists. I studied anthropology, you know, in college at the University of Colorado Boulder, and then from there went to law school and university in Tulane University in New Orleans. But as an anthropologist first and a lawyer second, I look at psychedelic use or entheogenic plant use or plant medicine use from the perspective I gathered reading Wade Davis and reading the DNA, the Cosmic Serpent, the Origins of Knowledge by Jeremy Narby, and reading Bielabache's work. I found this idea that for many thousands of years, people have used these plant medicines and the extracts thereof for not only their religious rituals, which are written about in this learned length by Brian Murescu in The Immortality Key, but also for hunting and for rites of passage and, yeah, for recreation. And I think in recreation, there has to be seen something sacred. And the realization that comes with that is the realization that sacredness is actually pretty fun. And spirituality is kind of cool. And you can have fun in a ceremony. And in fact, anthropologists write that the best shamans are the ones that are cracking jokes, and the best ceremonies are the ones where everybody's laughing the whole time. You get the cosmic giggle. And so that I think raises this really interesting point that is, I don't know, that is like, there's maybe something much more to what's in its early stages now when we arrive at the late stages that cannabis isn't even in yet, right? But is getting there. We have these beautiful consumer products and these designed mind states. Like when you go to the dispensary and you buy your dream cannabis or your focus cannabis or your move cannabis, like 1916, I think the brand does in Colorado, or like Loom does in Michigan. We may find that companies like Mind State Design, formerly Kykeon, are offering tailored mind states where you can say, okay, well, what do I need now? And I think that's you know, one potential future scenario. There are many more others, but it's one that is grounded in the historical use of these medicines, or these substances rather. And it has a little bit more fun to it than what many proponents of the medical only model, especially, you know, the founders of publicly traded companies who have criticized decriminalized nature, may want you to believe.
Yeah, I am right with you in the expansive future that could be possible and how much joy and play and celebration and connection and community are actually parts of healing, maybe feel less serious, but if the goal in getting relief from many of these maladies of the mind is to be in a state of play, why not have play be part of the process of healing itself? Let's talk about your interest in the indigenous relationship to these medicines. Between October of 2015 and October of 2016, you worked with ICERS, which is the International Center for Ethnobotanical Education, Research, and Service. And if people are familiar with psychedelics, they're probably familiar with ICERS. And you actually worked with them as a consultant to launch the Ayahuasca Defense Fund. Can you tell us a little bit about the what and why of the Ayahuasca Defense Fund? What is this fund and how does it work? And how was this part of your development in the psychedelic space? Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that ayahuasca and its practitioners are prosecuted all over the world. Often shamans coming from the Peruvian Amazon or the Brazilian Amazon with their ancestral medicine in their luggage will get stopped and arrested at customs. And lawyers have to get hired or volunteer to help them get out of those terrible situations. Otherwise, church groups that are serving it as their sacrament in their ceremonies are prevented from doing so and prosecuted to such an extent that the big ones have litigated for many, many years to protect that right. And the União do Vegetal, the Brazilian ayahuasca religion, the smaller of the two, the other one being Santo Daime, sued the U.S. government starting in 1999 in response to a seizure of their ayahuasca tea. And that case lasted for more than a decade. And they brought it all the way up from their regional court to the U.S. Supreme Court, where in 2006, they won. And the Supreme Court said, you, União do Vegetal, the UDV, have the right to use ayahuasca in your sacred ceremonies throughout the entire U.S. And then Santo Daime has won similar battles, not all the way to the Supreme Court, but regionally. But in other countries, they aren't so fortunate. And in even the U.S., the practitioners outside of these syncretic Christian religions, like shamanic practitioners, can't avail themselves necessarily of the same protection, at least explicitly. Although there's a colorable argument that can be made that they should be able to. And in order for coordination of people who can make that argument on behalf of the practitioners who are being prosecuted all over the world, ICERS formed the Ayahuasca Defense Fund, or ADF. And they were initially looking to name it the Teacher Plant Legal Defense Fund to focus on practitioners of all the different plants, right? Iboga and anyone serving any of these sacred plants all over the world, which are by and large indigenous peoples, right? Who do it as basically a profession, traveling the world, giving these religious services. So the ADF was born out of that need to serve these people. And it turns out that ayahuasca is kind of far and away the most widely used of these, although you can make a pretty good argument that psilocybin is quickly overtaking it, at least here in the US, Canada and in Jamaica, in the Netherlands as well, where the regulatory framework is quite clear on psilocybin, I think in part because it has more recreational use. And so it falls into this category of regulation that ayahuasca is decidedly not really in, because ayahuasca is in the category of religious freedom. It's where kind of constitutional laws and basic human rights apply and the exemptions for those, whereas psilocybin, even though it's used quasi-religiously, doesn't necessarily. And so when the ADF was formed, we did this big crowdfunding event, offered these amazing pieces of indigenous art and other gifts, and raised a substantial sum of money to accomplish that mission of anywhere in the world where people are getting in trouble for their sacred plant use, have protection and have a network to rely on, a group of people who can coordinate legal counsel and who can advocate on their behalf.
How is the fund doing these days? I assume you're not still involved as you were helping sort of launch it. Is the fund still active and still supporting?
Yep, it is. It is. And anybody who does encounter some kind of issue can reach out to the ADF and get help.
Wonderful. And we'll have links for that in the show notes. I'm glad we covered that because I really appreciate what the ADF does. So let's move on to Woven. So first of all, I'm really interested in the model of Woven as a company because you're not only investing in companies, you're also sort of building your own companies and ultimately creating an ecosystem of ethically based, best-in-class companies for psychedelic treatment and I think probably other modalities in addition to psychedelic therapy. So why the ecosystem approach? Why is Woven taking that?
We stand at the precipice of the birth of a new sector in a lot of ways. It's been around for a long time, right? Thousands of years, but there are a lot of new companies. There's a lot of investment pouring in, and there are a lot of startups raising money. And so what that is, in other terms, is kind of the formation of an ecosystem where a lot of seeds are getting planted. There are a lot of sprouts shooting up and a lot of newer kind of flora and fauna of corporations and organizations emerging. And so as a capital allocator, you have to consider that in these early stages of the birth of a new sector or a new industry or a new subsector, you know, whatever you want, the space, whatever you want to call it, you have the responsibility and the job of kind of cultivating this ecosystem and curating it. And so we took that kind of understanding of what our role is as a capital allocator, as kind of a company that makes investments and helps to build things. And we asked ourselves, like, well, what would psychedelics show us about this? You know, what's the right semantic framing for what we do? Some people say we're building a platform, like Atai Life Sciences, right? One of the earlier kind of platform investor companies in the space. And we think that that's a reasonable frame, but we can go deeper and have something that is more bespoke for what psychedelics really is, which is this quite holistic thing where there isn't just the medical, pure medicalization, right? There's all this other cool stuff going on, these consumer companies and, you know, all kinds of compelling work being done across the entire value chain or treatment arc, as we call it. And so it really looks more like a building an ecosystem than building a platform. And the model itself of Woven is a permanent capital vehicle. And what that means is that it's a corporation rather than a limited life fund. And the reason for that is that the time horizon is much longer, right? We're looking at the birth of an ecosystem here and now. The first publicly traded psychedelics company, right, was like 2020, right? MindMed. And now there are many, many, there's scores of them. And many more companies raising money and, you know, all kinds of activity, but it's still early innings. And so we said, you know, maybe we want to be around for 10 years or 20 years or 50 years. And in order for that to happen, we chose this structure of a C corporate, an LLC to be converted into a C corporation or a PBC, right? Which is a C corporation that has this special purpose or special social purpose. And so we chose that model very consciously because we want to be around to help build this ecosystem and we're in it for the long term. You know, we've all been in it for a long time and we're going to be in it for a long time. And a fund it suffers from some limitations. Like often the life is 7 years or 9 years. They're kind of hardcore capitalist motivators in the fund structure that aren't necessarily present in the PBC structure, for example. And the approach that we're bringing to building the psychedelic ecosystem, allocating capital within it, is informed by this new thinking of what post-capitalism can be or capitalism 2.0 can be. This conscious, informed way we're addressing our society and social system that it isn't just about making money, but is about solving social problems and making money doing it.
So looking at the existing psychedelic landscape, can we talk a little bit about ethics in psychedelic business. And something I always love is this criticize generally, compliment specifically. I love that invitation. So I'm wondering if we can look at the psychedelic landscape as it stands. And if you can highlight any companies that you love what they're doing from an ethical point of view, or if you notice trends that you feel like are really problematic from an ethical perspective, that might help further lay the foundation of why Woven is taking the approaches it is. What do you love and what trends are you finding problematic when you look out across the psychedelic landscape?
Well, one, Eamon, which is an easy answer, is Maya, right? One really cool thing about Maya is that it's not only structured as a public benefit corporation, a PBC, that has its special purpose embedded in its certificate of formation so that it's accountable to that for in perpetuity for the life of the corporation, which creates this interesting feedback loop that has the ability to trigger what's called a shareholder derivative action in the event that the directors of the corporation go awry and stop working to achieve the special social purpose. And so the shareholders can then say, well, we as responsible shareholders, as conscious capital, are going to trigger a shareholder derivative lawsuit and sue the directors for failure to achieve the public purpose in order to right the ship. And so Kamaya as a PBC and some of the other PBCs out there, like Horizons PBC, are really interesting models because they allow for that accountability and they allow for conscious capital to feel safe in investing into the company and socially responsible shareholders to feel empowered, to have agency in making sure that their money is not used to do evil, but is used to do good. And Maya's PBC allows for that.
Well, what's great about Maya is they also have Unlimited Sciences, this kind of sister nonprofit, this binary star system that is so popular in psychedelics today, that other companies like MAPS, with MAPS 501c3 nonprofit and MAPS PBC are doing. And some speculate like USONA Institute might do as well. Interestingly enough, like Compass Pathways started as a nonprofit and then converted to a for-profit later on. So maybe that's a path for USONA Institute too. We don't know. They haven't made any overt statements as to one path or the other. But I really like this novel corporate form use of PBCs and these binary star corporations with associated nonprofits. So that's a trend I enjoy because it seems like the founders in psychedelics are pretty interested in innovation and experimentation with novel business models. And so you have a willingness to adopt cool stuff like the PBC, which is a newer thing, and the twin 501c3 PBC. And even, I suspect, we'll start to see some DAOs.
Okay, so looking at some of the models that you're appreciating in the psychedelic landscape, what are some of the trends that you're concerned about? As we mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, like I find myself concerned about at-home psychedelic treatment without individuals present. I'm concerned about the safety of that. And also in an age of kind of disconnection where experiential psychedelic medicine is so much about connection and then integration, which is something that does well in community, this idea of at-home ketamine treatments, that concerns me. So that's one example, and maybe that's something you might want to speak to as well. But what are some sort of examples you're seeing in the psychedelic landscape that are of concern for you?
It's funny you mentioned that because when I was in Miami, and you're in Miami now, when I was last in Miami at Wonderland conference a few weeks ago, I was amazed by this direct-to-consumer ketamine phenomenon. I kind of couldn't believe how quickly it's taken off and found out that it's in large part due to a regulatory exemption that was issued during the pandemic that allowed for prescribers to basically prescribe these certain medicines that would otherwise require a doctor's visit wholly online so that a consumer or a prospective patient can take a short online survey, get the prescription sent to them and take it at home. And the business model was pioneered, at least the biggest success story, by a company called Cerebral that did this for Adderall and SSRIs. And it was like this skyrocketing success story. So the capitalists are like, wow, this is amazing. You know, look at how compelling the data is on adoption and growth of the company and the revenues and the user base growing so rapidly.
And it also, for the kind of conscious capitalist, gives you pause because you wonder whether this growth is due to an increasing pool of people who are maybe people who aren't necessarily using it in the way that a therapist would want if they were there in person. And so you have this weird phenomenon where this business model is shown to be really successful because of this regulatory exemption that's happened during the pandemic and the kind of Amazonification of everything where, you know, anything you want, you just order, get it delivered to you at home. It's a moral quandary. And I actually don't know how I feel about it. I'm kind of aghast and I'm kind of excited because in some ways it's like highly disruptive. It's like, well, maybe people can be trusted to take drugs at home. Like the message of the Last Supper, you know, it's okay to gather your friends around the table and take your sacramental wine and have your ceremony at home. You don't have to go to the state-sponsored Eleusis or the state-sponsored, you know, facility or the wild Dionysian party. You can just do it in the comfort of your own home. There's something highly disruptive and highly empowering about that. So there's these two things that I hold at once, which is why I don't know how to feel about it. I don't really know yet what my kind of final opinion is because I'm weighing these two different things. And I think that the way to cut it is to focus on ethical business practices for these companies so that anybody who's offering direct-to-consumer ketamine and likely in the future direct-to-consumer MDMA and direct-to-consumer psilocybin is doing it in a way that is imbued with corporate governance, corporate social responsibility, environmental social governance, ESG criteria and KPIs, key performance indicators, public reporting, crowdsourced accountability, so that, you know, say you're running a direct-to-consumer psychedelics company. It's not just ketamine now, it's, you know, 5 years from now, and there are all kinds of psychedelics on the market that can be offered to people to take by prescription or in clinic or at home. You're submitting an annual or quarterly report that says, you know, how did you perform? What have you done in the JEDI work? You know, justice on equity and diversity and inclusion. What have you done to promote prior care and integration and aftercare and community and some in-person visits? And all of this stuff that is just required so that the corporation that is doing this kind of high-risk business is doing it in a way that is accountable and transparent and follows industry standard ESG KPIs.
Ah, there's the rub. There is the rub. Because what are the governance structures that mean that companies must do things in this way? Because if you're entirely motivated by profit, then it doesn't make sense to put resources into these other aspects of the business. So for example, Woven is putting 10% into El Puente, which is this nonprofit we'll talk about in a moment. There's no incentive to do that if you're coming from a specifically profit motive. If your bottom line is just your shareholder returns, then there's no reason to do that. And I think that's when we get in to the issue with capitalism and psychedelics. What has made me most optimistic is this perspective from Jamie Wheel around psychedelic medicine, that there needs to be an attractor coalition of best practices in the psychedelic space, where being a part of that coalition has benefits that outweigh the cutting corners of sort of capitalism as it stands. And so if we have companies like, let's say, Woven or Journey Collab, which I really like, or Maya or other companies that are really doing these best practices from an ethical perspective, that hopefully that there's a value of being a part of that ecosystem that brings those practices on board for other companies. That's what makes me most optimistic. But overall, I don't know that I'm that optimistic about it.
Yeah, the good old peer pressure. It's really one of the best ways to serve the purpose of corporate social responsibility. It happens in anti-slavery and anti-human trafficking, where corporations are pressured by their peers to join certain organizations that serve as hubs for due diligence. It happens in conflict minerals, where you have the same, you have the Responsible Minerals Initiative, where basically any company that has tin, tungsten, tantalum, or gold in its supply chains, these 3TG minerals that come out of the conflict areas in the DRC, have to basically be a member of the RMI, and not only be a member of the RMI, but actually submit an annual report every year saying what did they do to make sure that, you know, they weren't getting minerals from warlords. And so you have multiple other examples to follow of peer pressure of corporations in particular high-risk areas, like conflict minerals, like global supply chains that may have slavery or human trafficking in them. And so we have a framework that's pretty easy to follow for psychedelics too, which I think many would argue is a high-risk industry also. For many years in human history, the shamans are not only considered to be good people, but also bad people. And there's great anthropological literature about these magical wars between tribes where the shamans are like doing evil shit, like shooting magic darts at each other and at people. So there is a high risk, and there may be risks in mental health. You know, there's all these risks. And so in order to self-regulate those high risks, you create these peer pressure groups like Jamie Wheel, who's a Woven Advisor, talks about. These coalitions of the willing, I call it, where people join an organization like the Responsible Minerals Initiative for Psychedelics, and they have to adhere to that organization's policies and their, crucially, in my mind, reporting framework. And the reason that I'm so focused on reporting framework is that I spent the first part of my career after law school analyzing many thousands of these reports that corporations made under social responsibility laws, or ESG laws as they're called. So like the conflict minerals rule in Dodd-Frank section 1502 says that every corporation that has tin, tungsten, tantalum, and gold in its supply chains in the US has to submit an annual report saying what diligence did they do to make sure that that resource wasn't coming from, you know, warlords. And similarly, California has a law called the California Transparency and Supply Chains Act that says every corporation over a certain size in California has to submit an annual report publicly on his website saying what did they do to make sure that they didn't have slaves and human trafficking in their supply chains. And so similarly, we can have that for psychedelics, right? And there's two ways to go about it that are simultaneous. One is do it ourselves. Say, okay, well, look at all these other industries. Let's create some self-regulation and systems of accountability, our own frameworks, our own ESG KPIs, you know, in our own governing bodies or membership organizations that people can become members of to signal that they're a good corporation, a good corporate person. And we can wait for regulators to do it for us, which is what ultimately happens no matter what. And what regulators love to do is say, okay, well, look at this initiative that was already adopted by this group of corporations. Let's just basically adopt that into law. And if you just wait for regulators without self-regulating first, then that's when you get into trouble.
Yeah, let's make the regulation that we most want, that particularly people who, like yourself, have spent time working with, you know, indigenous populations. Like, let's bring in all the things that really matter, so that when the regulators come knocking, we can be like, look, we're regulating ourselves. Here's how it works. So that's really smart.
And so we're going to advance this initiative. It's happening, right? Jamie Wheel's writing about it. You're talking about it. North Star made this first foray into it with the Ethics Pledge, and there's much more to come. So one thing that our chief innovation officer and co-founder, Giles Hayward, will talk about tomorrow at Horizons at the Responsible Business Forum, and the business forum itself, is this multi-stakeholder initiative we're launching to develop ESG KPIs for psychedelics. Which means companies like Maya, companies like Journey, investment funds like Vine will say, yeah, we all stand by this desire for companies to self-regulate within this industry, coalition of the willing for accountability. So let's together commission a qualitative study, you know, with proper data sampling and proper snowball sampling rather, and data analysis to identify what are the risks that everybody sees from all the different stakeholder groups, from nonprofits to for-profits, from drug developers to functional mushroom sellers, and get that risk matrix. And then out of that, develop a set of key performance indicators that companies can describe their progress in achieving every year in what is essentially a perennial North Star Ethics Pledge.
I love that. That brings us to El Puente and how Woven is particularly taking action. And Woven recently released, or El Puente, the El Puente Foundation, recently released a policy paper and a corporate social responsibility initiative, which is for psychedelic pharmaceutical companies to engage with indigenous people using psychedelic botanicals in traditional practice. Did you have a hand in writing this? This sounds very legal to me. Is this?
Yeah.
Were you involved? Were you involved in this paper? It uses a lot of interesting words.
Yeah, I like words, and I did. We commissioned the kind of initial research and writing from Greg Ferenstein at Frederick Research, who's a really good political mind, and I think a very advanced understanding of how to address multiple sides of issues, you know, and get basically a social scientific analysis of the information at hand, and then took that raw material that he gave us and polished it into the gem that you see before you today.
Nice. Well, let's talk about it. So there's four key components: biocultural conservation, appellations of origin, regulatory sandboxes, and financial sharing. I think the model here is super interesting. And so, yeah, I'd love for you to share these four key pillars.
Sure. And El Puente itself, just to give some context, is, you know, Woven's foundation and designed to build bridges between psychedelic companies and indigenous peoples. And so this paper is the first product of El Puente that is focused very much on this system of reciprocity, and specifically what are four policy solutions we can advance with policymakers, so regulators, and convince them to support. So we interviewed 26, 27 different stakeholders throughout the industry and asked them their thoughts on all this, and came to these four solutions. So the first, being biocultural conservation, is focused on legal actions that we can take to protect not only indigenous lands, but indigenous cultures too. On the cultural side, you have intellectual property, so the plant recipes and their applications. And you also have patterns, you know, ancestral patterns that I think are deserving of IP protection as well, and can be a source of great wealth, because when you have a rich culture and you have protections for that rich culture's cultural property, you can get rich people out of it.
And is that already covered by the Nagoya Protocol in terms of intellectual property?
Kind of. The Nagoya Protocol is, like, in many ways, an aspirational international law that lacks teeth, except for the implementation of it by corporations themselves in their own personal practices. Whereas the IP protections in general are very localized. So in order to get IP protection in the US, you have to file a patent in the US, or, you know, copyright registration, trademark registration. But then that thing isn't protected elsewhere. So if you want, for example, to protect an indigenous medicine in Peru, the US, Canada, and the EU and Australia, you have to file in each of those places the patent. And what I think what many people miss when they're thinking about indigenous people's plant medicines is that many of them are exposed to bioprospecting from pharmaceutical corporations who take the medical knowledge, create an extract, and test it for a certain indication, patent that, and don't share the benefits. And what the Nagoya Protocol is designed to do is give a framework for benefit sharing, so that when a pharmaceutical company does that, or a psychedelic startup that has aspirations of becoming a pharmaceutical company, they create access and benefit sharing agreements and arrangements. And a good example of that that we talk about in the policy paper is that of HGNH Pharmaceuticals with the San Bushmen. They have a access and benefit sharing arrangement and agreement whereby the anti-anxiety drug developed by HGNH out of a San plant called Canna, Silentium tortuosum, has royalty payments that go to the San, or a fund controlled by the San. And I think that model is and can be replicated in this space of entheogenic plants too. And one great group that is doing interesting work
in this field that is very deserving of support is the Amazon Conservation Team, headed by Mark Plotkin, who is a contemporary of Wade Davis among that group of students, taught by the eminent Harvard professor, Richard Evans Schultes, the father in many ways of modern ethnobotany. So you have those models that the Nagoya Protocol promotes for access and benefit sharing related to indigenous people's intellectual property. And then you have methodologies for consultation in a way that is respecting of their rights as communities and their sovereignty really as communities. And those are laid out by the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, UNDRIP, and International Labor Organization Convention Number 169, which together articulate this right of free, prior, and informed consent, which has teeth and has stopped many large projects in their tracks for failure to consult the Indigenous peoples who the projects impact. Those are mainly to do with natural resource exploitation, like mining and dams, forestry, logging, oil and gas development, and they only arise where nation states have domesticated the law that the UNDRIP and ILO 169 articulate because of the anarchic nature of international law, where like if the nation state isn't implementing it with their own domestic legislation, then it doesn't really apply because of this localized kind of power that's one of the hallmarks of the federalist system that we have in the U.S. and that is, you know, the international law system is in many ways based on. And so you have that on the IP side of things. And then you have the land rights side of things, which is also very compelling and in many ways more deserving of attention because it's so impactful. And because if you were to ask a Native person in Peru, for example, or here in the U.S. too, what's the top priority in terms of legal struggles? They might say our land rights, right? Our ownership of our land and our rights to our land and our rights to live in our land without it being exploited for its resources. Because even though indigenous peoples have titles to their land in the Peru and in the US, there are federal laws that say that the federal government has the right to the subsurface minerals, which means that, you know, companies can go in and exploit the minerals below the indigenous people's land and build the roads and the waste facilities and everything to get the uranium out or to get the oil out. And the people themselves are disempowered by those laws to fight back. And so it's laws like the Free, Prior, and Informed Consent Law I mentioned earlier that act as backstops against that, and the environmental impact statement laws as well. And so this first category of policy solutions that can be implemented to advance reciprocity with indigenous peoples focuses on this specific issue of biocultural conservation, the legal actions that we can take under the right to free, prior, and informed consent and under the access and benefit sharing agreements of private corporations that promote ownership by indigenous peoples and promote their rights.
And this also covers the appellations of origin as well, the intellectual property over the names and brands of psychedelics and their associated rituals. Is that in the same sort of category?
It's kind of born from that. So it's a continuation of that, right? In light of all of these being part of the same thing, which is reciprocity, you have to use kind of heuristics to divide them out into categories and say, okay, like here's this biocultural conservation idea specifically focused on conservation. And then here's this very specific idea of appellations of origin, which is super interesting, right? Right now, if you were to grow Chardonnay in California and make sparkling champagne from it, you couldn't sell it as champagne. Right? You could only sell it as champagne if you grow it in France by the traditional method and you make it by the traditional method and you get this cool international certification. And some of the indigenous groups we talked to, like Umiak in Colombia, said, for us, ayahuasca is not ayahuasca if you don't make it according to traditional practices, grow it in the Amazon, and even serve it in the Amazon. And we think that that's really cool and that ayahuasca should be afforded the same IP protections or appellations of origin as champagne. and so should peyote. So should all of the various native medicines that historically have been appropriated quite widely, to the point that many people don't recognize them as native medicines anymore, and they just recognize them as ordinary general medicine. So appellations of origin are a protective measure that can be taken at the international level to make sure that the only ayahuasca called ayahuasca in the radical commercial markets of the future is ayahuasca grown in and prepared in the traditional way from the traditional region.
Okay, let's move on to this regulatory sandboxes for entrepreneurship. And this is about supporting entrepreneurship in indigenous communities to develop their own products. And I feel like this is, if you're really talking about destabilizing the current capitalist conditions where those who already have get to have more and those who don't get more sort of taken away from them, I think special taxation and regulation exemptions for indigenous communities is a really interesting way to change that. It reminds me a little bit of like casinos in the US where there's like a particular regulation issue. But of course, when we look at casinos, there are some issues, of course, with that as well in terms of what's being created. But there is wealth being created to indigenous communities through casinos. So how does it work in the case of this particular policy paper?
Yeah, Eamon, this is my favorite one. And I think it's the most fun because it's a sandbox for one, and you know, that's a great playpen. But also because it answers the call that the UN made with their sustainable development goals as the very first goal of poverty alleviation. And it speaks to the reality of many indigenous communities, which is living in poverty, and which is an injustice, right? It shouldn't be the case. These are rich cultures with rich lands, and they should be rich. If they want to, not up to me to decide. But what a regulatory sandbox does is it allows people who have entrepreneurial spirit to develop businesses in a way that isn't hampered by the same regulations that would otherwise apply. It's pretty common in fintech. So certain kind of financial startups can be in this regulatory sandbox where they can raise money easier, they can kind of take risks, and they can move quickly and kind of break some things, but they're just toys in the sandbox, so it doesn't really matter if they break. And it's gained a lot of popularity more recently. So in Utah right now, some regulators want to expand the use of regulatory sandboxes from just fintech into other industries. I think this is a very perfect place for psychedelics, because you have these business models that are dealing with controlled substances in many cases, but they're doing it in ways that are really responsible. Like, you have clinicians and therapists who've taken vows and taken Hippocratic oaths to heal people and to serve people, and people who take their roles very seriously and who are self-regulating very effectively and are otherwise hampered by external regulations that usually apply. So imagine this: the sovereignty of indigenous nations aside, right? Native peoples have the right to self-determination, which means that they really can articulate their own legal structures and legal frameworks, and they can legalize cannabis or legalize psychedelics if they want, technically. Not really the case in practice, just because of how laws are applied. You have these sovereign indigenous nations who have ancestral healing practices, medicines and methodologies for using them that in many ways can be professionalized and provided as a service if they want. And in Peru, you know, many shamans are starting businesses providing ayahuasca as a service. And you have regulators who say, great, we're going to defer to this group. We're going to offer this regulatory sandbox and allow them to experiment with their clinical models, their treatment models. And we're going to say that the controlled substances laws that would otherwise apply to entheogenic plants don't apply in this context. Great. So there's a sandbox. What makes it really interesting from an investment perspective, which then ultimately fosters the ecosystem, right, and builds the innovation, because then the founders have access to capital and can build with that money, is this idea of opportunity zone tax incentives, which say, in summary, that people can defer capital gains taxes if they invest into real estate projects or funds investing in those projects in low-income communities designated as opportunity zones. And so if somebody's made a ton of money in the stock market or a ton of money in the crypto markets, and they have a huge capital gains tax bill that is coming due. What they can do is take those capital gains and reinvest them into these real estate projects in low-income communities and leave it there for a while, just depending upon how long is the size of the tax break, all the way to zero if it's in for more than a decade. And then when they pull it out, they don't have to pay that capital gains tax. And you can imagine that's very appealing when people are looking at tax bills in the millions or tens of millions of dollars. And it also fosters this reciprocity in the way that the capital is moving. It's not just going in as an investment and then coming out with the profits, with the portion paid in taxes in general. It's saying going in as an investment and then going into another investment that solves a social problem and then comes out. So it answers this call for a new kind of capitalism that is centered around making money, solving social problems. So when you combine those two things, this idea of incentives for investment and incentives for entrepreneurship through regulatory easement or deference, you have something that can foster the growth of a psychedelic product and care ecosystem. And you do it in a way that regulators are comfortable with, because it turns out that, especially in the US, in the federalist system, regulators are not interested in putting onerous regulations on business. What they actually are more interested in doing is deregulating markets, promoting free markets. And what a regulatory sandbox does is it allows them to take that role of saying, here's an area where we can make a limited free market. Instead of the other side of the coin, which is like, here's an area where we have to mandate corporations behave in a certain way, which regulators are not really interested in doing.
Well, so that mandate language that you've just used is used in the final point, which is in financial sharing, which is written here, mandates for how companies should mm-hmm. share a portion of revenue with designated indigenous groups. Financial sharing does seem to be a case where you would actually need a mandate if you really wanted to make sure that companies were giving a portion into an indigenous reciprocity fund a la Journey Collab. Is that the case for how you're looking at financial sharing through this paper, and how would that work in practice?
Yeah, Eamon, so you're right. This is the hardest one. And our findings from the report were that this is the least likely policy solution to succeed, because getting regulators to mandate corporations share their finances or share their ownership with indigenous peoples, and really with anyone, is very difficult. They're probably going to say no. So what do we propose as the solution here? We propose corporations leading by example, because where regulators may not be interested in acting, we have corporations that have clearly demonstrated interest in acting, like Journey Collab, for example, putting shares of its own into a trust for the benefit of indigenous peoples, like Woven, putting 10% of its equity into El Puente for the benefit of indigenous peoples, controlled by a council of elders that has veto powers in project financing decisions, or HGNH Pharmaceuticals developing Zembrin antidepressant, an anti-anxiety drug from Solentium Tortuosum with an access and benefit sharing agreement with the SOD. Or one example we pull for the paper is the Kani tribe in India, who have a benefit sharing agreement for the drug Jivani from plant research by the Tropical Botanical Garden and Research Institute, which is an interesting example if you're looking for kind of failures to learn from. Because that access and benefit sharing agreement actually facilitated biopiracy. And so it actually became the very thing it swore to destroy. So what we propose is that corporations lead by example and say, well, we understand that regulators aren't necessarily going to work on this or pass these kinds of mandates, but we ourselves believe in them. And we ourselves want to take these steps to create access and benefit sharing. And so we'll lead by example. And the beauty of this policy paper is that it's serving as the foundation for the birth of a community and groups of people who are working on this kind of stuff from different angles to come together and coordinate within working groups loosely affiliated with each of these four initiatives. So here in the financial sharing working group, we have a group of corporations and representatives, really representatives of those corporations, who are interested in these issues and interested in pioneering different approaches for ownership sharing and financial sharing. And so while policymakers and regulators may not be interested in mandating these kinds of things, the groups of people that are emerging as a result of this paper and able to coordinate together through the channels that we're creating for doing so, starting with Discord, are nevertheless still taking action. And so even though we've indicated that this is not likely to succeed on the regulatory front, we've found that it is likely to succeed from the peer pressure front.
So this brings me to the question that I always have. If you take two companies, one of whom is sharing profits or sharing a portion of revenue with indigenous communities, and one is not, it seems that the one who is not would be better able to compete in the sort of bare bones capitalist framework of our modern lives. So if you're looking at the growth of psychedelic companies, it seems like the ones who are not doing any of this ethical stuff would actually potentially have an advantage in terms of how much money they're making, how much they're able to like patent hoard or whatever, like all these things that companies who are not taking an ethical approach, it seems like they would be able to outcompete those companies that are taking a more ethical approach, because the companies that are taking an ethical approach are in a sense encumbered by these restrictions that they put on themselves. Is that the case? And if that's not the case, why is a more ethical company able to outcompete a less ethical company in the psychedelic space and beyond?
I think what it boils down to is consumer preference and shareholder preference. The two greatest actors in a capitalist world are consumers and shareholders. Corporations serve both. And if they're not satisfying one or the other, they're typically going to fail. And so then the question becomes, who's really the agent here? Who has agency? Is it the corporation? Or is it the consumer? Or is it the shareholder? And I think that in a world where consumers have well-articulated preferences and value sets, and shareholders do as well, you're going to have corporations that serve their interests and that outcompete other ones that don't. So that, for example, a fashion company that uses slave labor and everybody knows it, is not able to succeed in the marketplace, even though their costs of production are lower, you know, even though they have cheaper costs of goods sold or whatever, the consumers aren't buying and the shareholders aren't investing. So again, it boils down to this question of who really has agency. And we often find in our own lives, in the microcosm of our lives, compared to the macrocosm of society, that we don't want to take agency, and that we'd rather pretend that somebody else is the agent or has the power. And when we start to realize the power vested in ourselves, then we create a better world, even in the little microcosm of our own lives, right? When you lucid dream, you start to gain more agency. And as consumers voting with dollars, voting with our money and the preferences of what we're buying and how we're treating them, I think we can influence corporate behavior. Even in this situation where a corporation with lower costs of goods sold that is cutting corners may seem like it can outcompete. And so I'm very optimistic about psychedelics because I think that they foster conscious consumerism, and the consumer base is already quite conscious. So people are looking to buy these consciously produced products. And maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe people would rather just get their DTC ketamine in a box and take it without knowing the supply chain, without feeling like a member of a community and having support structures and organization. And maybe that's the world that some companies are building for and some shareholders are investing in, where they'd rather design some custom tailor-made
synthetic psychedelic that is not only enlightening, but also addicting and, you know, does all this funky shit that is evil.
Maybe people are designing this for this evil future. I don't know, but I'm very optimistic about the consumer base and the shareholder base in psychedelics driving corporate behavior in the right direction so that the only companies that can compete effectively and win in the long term, companies that have ethical, sustainable business practices, are submitting their annual reports to this membership organization, this coalition of the willing, and that are serving conscious consumers. And then on the shareholder side, I'm optimistic that the kind of capital that is drawn to psychedelics is quite conscious capital. And the shareholder pool or the investor pool contains a lot of socially responsible investors.
Jesse, we're coming to the end of our time together. And so as we land this particular conversation, I always enjoy the moment where I offer our guests the opportunity to speak directly to psychedelic practitioners, those who are currently working to heal with psychedelics, those who aspire to, and those who are interested in psychedelics as a mode of healing. If you had a moment, which in fact now you do, to speak to that population, what would you like to say?
I would say study shamanism from an anthropological perspective, to ground the work that you do now in the work that has been done since the earliest stages of our species, when it may be that the first specialization was that of a psychedelic healer, otherwise known as the shaman. But when studying shaman, keep in mind this mantra that I hold internally, which is that shaman begins with sham.
Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth? There's a lot of squirrely shamans out there. The shamans who I feel most resonance with, who are not the non-indigenous shamans who I feel most resonance with, would never let themselves be called shamans.
That's right.
They're like, I'm a facilitator. Mr. Shaman is my dad. Jesse, what a pleasure to meet you. I love what you're doing. How can our listeners follow Woven, follow you, El Puente, get involved, contact you? I know we talked about that policy paper. That'll be in the show notes. But how can people keep connected with you?
Well, thanks, Eamon. It's really been a pleasure chatting with you and meeting you too. People can reach me at jesse@woven.science. And that's really the best way. I'm not really on Twitter. Should be, but maybe we'll get there eventually.
Well, Jesse, it's such a pleasure to get to know you and really appreciate your time today.
Thanks. You too, Eamon.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.